So something that I don't freely admit to everybody is that I am, for the first time, getting through the Harry Potter series. All of them.
Oh my gosh.
I'm currently halfway through the fourth book. I don't like reading. We've talked about this.
This is actually a point of pain in our relationship.
I have two books from you.
Yes.
On my coffee table. Haven't touched them.
I know you haven't.
Yeah.
I've committed you several times.
You
will not.
I don't know what it is. But when you do an audio book, because I'm huge into podcasts, that's essentially what an audio book is. It's just this big, long narrative thing.
Yeah.
I am loving it. Turns out Harry Potter is pretty good.
It's a good podcast.
It's a really long podcast. I mean, the fourth book alone is like 20 hours of content.
Gosh.
But anyway, yeah, I'm using Audible and, I'm very much enjoying it. So, I wanted to tell our listeners that we actually have a banner on our website where you can go and if you go specifically through our website and go to Audible and sign up for Audible, then you can get 30 days free. A lot of places you can get 7 days free. You can get a 14-day free trial, but through us, you can get a 30-day free trial of Audible, because then you can try it. You can listen to all 20 hours of the fourth Harry Potter book, and if you don't like it, then you can leave. There's no contract or anything.
So 30 days seems like a lot. Seems like a lot of time to get for free.
Yeah.
Is it because all of the executives at Audible are fans of this podcast?
Every single one of them.
I figured that.
Yeah.
I suspected that. This is proof.
I got a phone call and it was like, hey, we love your podcast. And I'm like, who's we? And it was like, the entire advisory board at Amazon. I was like, that makes sense. I understand.
Amazon?
Amazon owns Audible. You didn't know that?
Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, we jumped all the way to Amazon.
All the time that he's spending on Blue Origin and his penis rocket, he is listening to Nerd Critic.
Turns out he loves Nerd Critic.
He loves Nerd Critic.
And he's like, hey, you know what
we're
going to do?
Every time he takes a Bic to his head, he's listening to Nerd Critic.
He's like, you know what we're going to do for you, CJ? And I'm like, what? And he's like, we're going to give you 30 days free.
30 days free to anybody who listens to Nerd Critic.
The best they can offer.
We're all recording.
Yeah.
So
I mean, we're technically started.
Technically, we started months ago.
When should I do all of my vocal exercises? It usually just takes like 20, 25 minutes.
I would go ahead and start those now. If you could go ahead and just take yourself off of the if you could mute.
Okay.
Perfect. Great. Boy, I guess we better probably say hello and welcome to Nerd Critic, a podcast about big movies from the dual perspective of critical nerdiness. My name is Jordan.
And I am CJ. Jordan here is our studied and credentialed critic.
And CJ is our resident nerd. CJ, I would ask you what you're wearing today, but I don't care. What I care about is who is the other person that we've been listening to in our ears
now. Should we introduce him all epically, or should we allow him to do so?
Well, I feel like you've already just sort of deflated the balloon of epicness.
I'm so sorry. I apologize.
So I think we're going to have to let Tommy try to salvage whatever introduction he can. Go ahead, man.
Hey, everybody. Here's a twist. I've been here the whole time. Woo! My name is Tommy Metz III, or Tommy Handsome. I am a guest from the Next Reels film board, starring Peter Wright and Andy Nelson. And you guys have been nice enough to have me on, because Jordan, you joined us on our podcast, and it is an absolute pleasure to be here so far.
It is an absolute pleasure to have you so far. I anticipate nothing but positive things from here on out.
Yep.
Don't disappoint me. So I am actually, this is a real treat, because I feel like on some level, not to spoil too much, but on some level, I feel like we won, because we're covering a movie this week, Dr. Sleep, that I very much enjoyed.
Okay.
And when I was on the Next Reel, the film board, I was invited to discuss a movie that I did not very much enjoy. Right. So this is a real treat for me.
This worked out for you.
Yes, and I think it should be a real treat for you too, Tommy.
I am curious though, Tommy. It seemed as though when he said I very much enjoyed, there was a bit of surprise in your voice.
Was there? I don't know. I'm not a big spoiler person.
All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and just move right along into our so this is just a quick recap of where we are for some context. We covered The Shining a couple of weeks ago on our Off the Shelf episode, which Tommy, you said you listened to, and I will be putting you on the spot for feedback.
Deal.
Shortly. But we covered that movie because Dr. Sleep is basically a direct sequel of The Shining, which is weird. I didn't even know, because I'm not a huge Stephen King fan. I'm a fan. I love Stephen King, but I'm not a huge Stephen King fan. I don't know how many people exist in the world who know all of his books. I am certainly not one of them.
I might be one of those people, not to be that excited, okay. But I'm an enormous Stephen King fan, for whatever that's worth. It's not worth a lot.
It is. No, it's worth a lot.
Okay, go ahead.
Ladies.
Yeah. Hey, anyone want to know about the Dark Tower series? No one? Goodbye. Yeah.
I'm sensing a bit of a trail of breadcrumbs here, too, because you were surprised that I like Dr. Sleep, and you are a giant Stephen King fan. So, yeah. All right, let's... so, basically, this is a book... it was based on a book by Stephen King called Dr. Sleep, I imagine, that was based on the book called The Shining, I imagine, by, I imagine, Stephen King. So this is all of that checks out. All in my imagination. And so I didn't know that this thing existed until a few months ago when the trailers started dropping. And I was like, what is this interesting sequel to The Shining? And I almost thought at first that it was just out of nowhere, that someone was just like, oh, it would be a cool, here, I have a cool story idea. But no, it's a book, and it was made into a movie, and here we are. It was directed by, oh, this is embarrassing, I don't have my notes in front of me.
Mike Flanagan,
thank you. The guy who did Haunting of Hill House, which was hugely successful on Netflix. And so we've got a really good cast.
Yep.
I would say at least better than competent writer-director, if not really great. And I'm not saying he's not really great.
Sure.
I'm just saying at least you have to say he's better than competent. Because of his past work. I'm not super familiar with a lot of his past work, but I have seen Haunting of Hill House. So this is a movie that kind of snuck up on me, and I don't think we need to give any more context notes, other than I think one of the reasons that I showed up was because of Rebecca Ferguson, who I love.
Sure.
Ewan McGregor?
Ewan McGregor, who I tolerate.
What?
should leave right now.
Ewan McGregor, who I sometimes love and sometimes am fine with. Rebecca Ferguson has not disappointed me yet.
The only other context note I think we should give is that the Shining book, I believe, was written in the 70s, and then Dr. Sleep was written, I believe, in 2013.
Oh my gosh.
So okay. Way later. So yeah, Tommy, yeah, I believe that you have read both books. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, CJ. Correct.
Okay. Without going into spoilers, for those...
I need to embarrass myself first. Okay. I have read neither.
Neither have I. But we've established I'm not
so
much of a reader.
I'm so glad you're here, Tom.
No, it's
this is a value for us.
I've read Dr. Sleep and the Bible. And those are the only two books that I've ever read. So I'm glad that I'm here. This is exciting.
Great. I'm curious, without going into spoilers, I want to jump into the spoiler free, but I'm curious as from the perspective of a giant Stephen King fan and someone who's read the book, how'd it do?
This was a really, I just saw it today, actually, and this was a really interesting experience because when I've ever read a book and then seen a movie later of it, it's never the same. Like, I really like one and don't like the other. And this is one of the first times that I've really felt the same about the book as I did with the movie. which was really interesting and rare. Unfortunately, I didn't like the book. And so sliding right in is the movie, which I think unfortunately suffers from the same problems for me, in my opinion, that the book did.
I can't wait to get into that.
And that being said, so, when you said about the cast, I thought, I mean, everyone was remarkable in it, and I am an enormous Mike Flanagan fan. Ever since Oculus in 2000 and I don't know, some number, he's been one of my favorites. He's, I think, one of the most exciting new horror movie directors that we have that isn't trying to be completely artsy and weird and freak everybody out. And this, I don't blame any of this on him because I love him and I'm hoping he might adopt me. Go ahead.
Okay.
Great. That's good to know. I, as we have established on this podcast in the past, I am not well versed in the horror genre.
So sure.
Mike Flanagan, I had heard of because, you know, I'm dialed in. So I've heard of, like, I've heard of Hush and, and some of his other movies, and Haunting of Hill House, obviously.
Yep.
But I had no experience with him. So it sounds like, it sounds like we got Tommy on one side and we got Jordan on the other side.
And where is CJ?
I am in the middle, probably Tommy side leaning.
Okay.
sorry, Jordan.
You know what? This is how you started out. Right? That's how you started out with Joker too. So
and then you ended up
more on my side, as I recall.
That's true. It might happen.
Take here. That, Dixon.
I've thought a lot about this movie, and I'm. It seems to be a movie that it's in my mind, and it will be for a long time. And there will be several instances that I will be driving down the road and I'll just think about it for a long time and I will ponder it. And that could be the quality of a good movie.
Sure.
But I just don't know where those thoughts are going to take me yet. So
all right. Interesting.
My enjoyment level while I was watching the movie was subpar, with a disappointing ending.
Okay. All right. Well,
that's where I land.
Okay. All right. Well, you know what? 76% of Rotten Tomatoes reviewers disagree with you. Yeah. I feel like I am carrying the majority vote in my heart. But it is relatively meaningless because I've disagreed with the majority plenty of times in my life.
You're not a bandwagon guy. That's something you made very clear on our podcast.
Thank you for remembering. So I think I want to, just to get us started on the right foot here.
Yeah.
I would like to hear your thoughts about our thoughts about The Shining.
at random order. Let's see.
CJ, random is fine.
Here, I'm very agreement. That's a sentence. I'm very akin to so many of the things that you guys said in your podcast. Number one, Jordan, I too am very much not a huge fan of the auteur theory. I find filmmaking to be such a collaborative experience that I don't even like the possessive credit when it says a film by the director. I like it came into fashion for a little bit, then fell out, but a film directed by. Like, I like that more. I don't like one person being like, and this is me, ta-da, you're welcome. Because it's just so many visions and so much input and not one person. You did bring up auteur. You said that Kubrick could fall into that category. I completely do agree. I also would like to maybe put David Fincher in that category of a rewarded person that is rewarded of that, because you always kind of know when you're watching a Fincher film, at the very least, because you're like, is everything like a kind of like a little bit nauseous yellow green, but in a really cool way? Like, he has such color correction. And then CJ, for you, I'm also very much not a classicist. You very famously on the Shining podcast, I believe, summed up Godfather Prime as
Godfather Prime. I like that. I haven't heard that
The film nerd part of me wanted to kind of drive off the 405, but yeah, then I was like, there's definitely room for that. Just because it's the first movie ever made doesn't make it the best movie ever made. And so we can respect classics. We don't necessarily have to enjoy them. And I liked how you watching Godfather 2 made you sort of appreciate Godfather 1 more. I'm also a huge fan of watching movies over again. So no, I thought that was all really interesting. I myself, as far as The Shining is concerned, is an enormous fan. And because I'm so excited, horror is my favorite genre. And so I've seen The Shining a ton. I watch it with my family every year for Christmas.
That's what it sounded like it was going.
Yeah. So.
No, but it is a Christmas movie.
Yeah. But I have watched it a ton, and I think it's a masterpiece. And yeah, did that answer your question? Did that sort of like make
absolutely.
A bed for this? Okay.
No, absolutely. Great. So I'm gonna let you keep on. I'm gonna let you keep your momentum and give us a very high level. Just in a few sentences, your sort of summary of your feelings about, this is basically just for people who are tuning in just for the first part before they really, before we really start talking about it.
You already said that it is a sequel to The Shining. So I'm allowed to use that in these sentences. The problem with the movie is the same problem that I had with the book, is it's too many books. And this, for me, is too many movies. There's a great movie in there that involves Stephen King's, and he is his latest book, The Institution, involved this exact same thing. He has a fascination with the idea of supernaturally, I guess that's the word, gifted children being either fed upon or used by jerk adults. That's what The Institution is about. Even It, I know you guys reviewed It and It too. He's feeding on certain children's fear. Like, he's really obsessed with this. And then there's everything about The Shining. I feel like it doesn't exist in the same movie. That everything that we know about The Shining from Danny Torrance, he doesn't have telekinesis. He doesn't have all of these crazy powers. He's just able to read people's minds and sort of see the undercurrent of the supernatural world below the world that is currently existing. And I always felt it, for me, respectfully, as I said, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. It felt very ham-fisted and very forced to make this a sequel to The Shining. It was its own story. And same with the movie. I loved the story with these kids and Abra and all this stuff. And then they're forcing in, for me, all of this Danny Torrance stuff and all of this stuff going back to the Overlook. It's just too many movies. And they don't really link up to me. And it just is too long. It feels too padded. And that's sort of my feeling, unfortunately. It's very frustrating.
Well, I mean, I might as well not be here. That was nearly every gripe I had about it.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, so if you both had to kind of give a recommendation for whether or not people should go see this, are you both kind of coming down on the sort of negative side of the fence saying,
I can
sit this one out?
No, I think that you should go see this because it's a talented filmmaker making a good movie.
Agreed.
If you can put it out of your mind that it is a sequel to The Shining, if you can put out the tone and the eeriness of The Shining out of your mind and don't expect that, then you're going to watch kind of a cool supernatural, I hate to say it, a little bit superhero like movie.
I mean Abra has supernatural power. I mean, superhero powers. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And Tommy, I don't know if you know comic books very much, but there is a subset of the Justice League called the Justice League Dark, which they're basically just a bunch of anti-heroes that deal with supernatural issues. Ooh. This was a really good Justice League Dark movie.
Interesting.
This was not a great sequel to The Shining.
Okay. This is great. I finally found my salt. And here it is.
Your salt.
Do we need to just throw a spoiler warning down yet?
No.
Okay.
I'm not
going to
spoil anything. I'm just going to say
Willis was dead the whole time.
I'm going to call both of you to task here and say you can't come into a movie like this and judge it solely based on its appropriate sequelness because it is technically a sequel. Like, you can't let The Shining dictate your opinion of this movie so completely. Both of you are basically saying, if it's not a sequel to The Shining, it's a good movie. It's either a good movie or it's not a good movie. It's just like adaptation. If you like a book a lot, but and then a movie that is based on the book is not very much like the book, but it's still a good movie, it may not be a perfect faithful adaptation, but that doesn't mean it's a bad movie.
Jordan, with all due respect, I would like to thoughtfully try to disagree, because I believe that
so many qualifiers.
I know, I almost passed out. Is because I'm a guest, so I'm trying to be like,
ball your fists, take out your knife, draw a gun, I don't care.
Because, and I'm not trying to make a pun here, this movie is haunted by The Shining. It spends so much
You were trying to make a pun. Don't lie to me.
I just gave a high five to Mr. Pun. He lives in my apartment. I don't know what that meant. Because this movie spends so much time having to be so reverential and so deferential and so representative of The Shining that it can't be its own thing. And I think, personally, that really hurts it.
Okay, that's fair. You know what? Let's we're going to talk more about that, because I don't want to talk any more about that without spoiling things.
Right.
Okay. So let's before we dive into our deconstruction of what we believe are the problems or the strengths and our disagreements about those two things in this movie, let's talk about the things that we genuinely liked. And from this point forward, I think we should go ahead and say we're going to spoil this movie for people.
And this is a movie that that has not like amazing surprises, but there's enough to unravel in the world.
I think this is a valued spoiler.
Yeah,
if you're interested in seeing this movie and you haven't seen it, then maybe go ahead and stop listening now and come back when you've seen it.
Yeah.
I would say that. Yeah. For this movie, I definitely would say that. And agreed. I believe also, if at least two out of three of us, and maybe you agree, Tommy, that it is a movie worth watching. So
yes.
Okay.
No, I do. All right, because good. It's such a beautifully, at times, made movie and has such great set pieces and stuff. I'm just frustrated by the overall. But yes.
Sure, sure.
This All is right, not, well, in no way is this like movie a mess or an absolute failure. No.
So with that said, go see the movie, listeners, and come back when you're ready for some spoilers. And now we're going to spoil it. And Tommy, I'm going to make you go first. You got to tell me some things you liked about this movie.
Sure. Rebecca Ferguson plays Rose the Hat. She is a national treasure, and she's so good in this movie.
Amen, Anna, amen.
I feel like this movie hangs around her neck. Is that a phrase? I don't know, but like... It's in her hat. I don't know how words work, but I mean, one of the reasons this movie, I think the two biggest reasons this movie, when it works is her. And then I apologize, I did not pull up IMDb like I was supposed to. The actress, the new young actress playing Abra.
Kylie Curran
is so winning and so great. You just immediately so on her side. I thought both of them really knocked it out of the park.
Absolutely.
Which was exciting. Yeah.
How did you feel about Mr. McGregor?
He was good. I don't know why it was like, he was good. Anyways, back to Rebecca Ferguson. No, he was really good. I liked that he'd had a transformation in the movie, because I was having a little anxiety of like, am I going to be having to look at bloodshot Beardy Magoo the entire movie? Because he was gross looking. I generally have a little bit of trouble with his American accent in movies.
Sure.
I don't know if that's I'm alone in that, but I always kind of feel it sort of coming in and out a little bit. But I thought he was interesting, and I thought he was very he brought the movie along nicely, and he made a good transition. I thought the acting for almost everybody was dynamite. Wait, almost everybody. I don't know why I'm qualifying it. I thought the acting was really great throughout. And I thought that, Jacob Tremblay's murder scene was like genuinely upsetting. I was surprised.
This feels weird to nerd out about that.
Yeah.
But like, honestly, that is kind of when I went all in. I had like,
That they went that far with it?
Yeah, yeah. So from the moment that, you know, you see him getting scouted.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible thing.
I love how we're all so uncomfortable talking.
To him getting abducted in the van and getting tortured and killed in a field. That scene was so horrific in the truest sense.
Yeah.
That I felt myself, like, my soul recoiled in a way that, like, has not happened in a movie in a long time.
It went farther with a kid involved that I mean, there was very little actual gore, but Mike Flanagan really pushed it.
The way that he showed it, he showed everything that mattered.
Yes.
He showed every shot that mattered, he showed.
Smart.
And so you didn't need to see the
guts.
The gory details,
right.
The guts, the whatever. You just needed to see his face and their faces.
Yeah.
And that shot he repeatedly went back to of them all huddled over this child.
Oof.
It was very, very, very hard to watch.
I was surprised the studio let it, even this version. I guess they really need it. This is the stake, and the rest of this movie is we want these people to be defeated and to suffer. It's based on this one thing, but
it's so hard to buy that from an audience. It's so hard to earn our thirst for revenge. And in a way that is morally justified, because I think revenge porn is a thing that is sort of despicable, and I'm glad that there's not a lot of like really popular movies that are straight up revenge porns anymore.
Sure.
I'm thinking of like, what was it, Dark Man back in the 80s or 90s, and those kinds of like,
yeah,
the whole, like, or even Man on Fire with Denzel Washington. There's a lot of like this.
The Crow, you know, John Wick.
Or The Crow. Yeah, The Crow. Well, John Wick is good. John Wick is satire.
Right.
And it's wonderful.
Sure.
But it's and it's very clear that no one that is being no one who is suffering vengeance is real.
They're all cartoon people.
It's such a cartoon.
Yeah.
This movie shows us a scene that demands the death of these people.
Yeah, it's a good and, it's a and great that, way to say it. Yeah.
And that is very, very powerful. There's a lot of things that I think would not work. And this is the reason the scene bought me in so hard, is because not only was it more emotionally like effective on like a level that I don't think I'll ever get rid of. But it also made everything else work. Like it made the revenge narrative work. It also made it make sense that Abra would feel it, because that, like, you know, she's what, all, like, all the way across the country or whatever, like,
but like psychically connected. Right?
Yes, yeah. It's a bit of a credulity strain to say that, like, you know, it feels too easy or coincidental, but because that scene was so powerful, you don't really question it. You're just like, yeah, of course this would be a nightmare for her too.
Yeah.
And like this would reverberate in some way.
I think it should. We should note that the editor of this movie was Mike Flanagan.
Right. He edits all of his.
He edits all of his movies. And
yeah.
I think that scene in particular, because if we talk about all the things that scene was getting across, it was getting across this group of I don't want to say hippies.
We'll say demons.
Demons, sure.
Yeah.
This group of demons are truly that bad. They abduct children. They have to torture, and the person has to be scared for them to get the steam. Then the steam is what keeps them young and keeps them alive and almost kind of immortal. Also, there's Abra, who's across the nation, that's seeing this. She's psychically connected, but then Rose also can see Abra seeing.
Yeah.
That scene communicates all of that.
It's the total setup.
While you're just torturously, just
and the
connection
ensures
to Ewan McGregor when Murder Red Rum first shows up.
Yes.
I think that whole set piece is expertly done. For as unpleasant as it is, it is a masterclass. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, CJ.
Oh, no,
but I got so excited that I wanted to co-opt your thoughts. I think it's a masterclass of intercutting.
Yes.
Intercutting between all these different
people. Never apologize for cutting CJ off. I do it all the time.
Okay. I just get so excited.
The last thing I wanted to say that this buys, because it buys so much, is it like, okay, let's say Rebecca Ferguson at her most devilishly charming versus Ewan McGregor as a sad sack. Who wins audience sympathy? Rebecca Ferguson. It was so hard for this movie to get us to not want Rebecca Ferguson to win.
Oh, man.
But that scene,
I disagree passionately, but continue.
That scene.
I agree with Jordan because she's so winning. And she's tough, and she's barefoot and she's cool.
Oh, she's a captivating presence on the screen.
She really is.
Which is also important. You don't want to dial that down. You want her to be she has to be an overwhelming force. And that's what she is.
She's
and,
the devil. Yeah. Is what she is.
And when you first are introduced to her, you are bewitched by her.
Yeah.
And a little afraid of her, because in that scene that you meet her, you know something bad's gonna happen.
With Violet,
she's bad and she's scary, but she's also, boy, is she sexy and cool and beautiful and charming and smart. And you would follow her. And then, so what do we need to see then to get us to go against her emotionally, to get the audience to stop feeling like they want her to win? and that is the most horrific
death with one of the most adorable little boy actors that we have, who universally loved. Can I interject something as a reader of the book? You know what sounds stupid when you read it? Rose the Hat. You know what sounds great in kind of a little bit of an Irish lilt? Rose the Hat. That was a great. I don't remember if she's Irish. Would you say that was like a little bit of an Irish accent?
I picked up Irish.
Yeah, that made it work. Because when she first introduced herself, I was like, okay. How's this going to work? Because your name is dumb. And as soon as she said it, I was like, I'm in.
Especially when you have Crow Daddy and Snake Bite Andy.
Craw Daddy and Big Belly Steve or all of their weird names.
And then you have Rose the Hat. Why isn't it Rose the Flower? You know what I mean? It's already Rose. Why double it up on objects? So my relationship with Ewan McGregor in this movie was apparently very different.
Oh, wait.
I'm not poo-pooing Ewan McGregor. Okay. I'm just saying that if you're
competing... You poo-pooed a little.
I know, at the beginning I said sometimes I don't like him that much. I'm saying if you pit him against Rebecca Ferguson...
Sure, especially...
In a popularity contest in this movie, it's going to be hard for him to win.
Yeah, especially this movie. I get that. I want to nerd out. This is less about scene-specific thing, and this is actually more theme. But this is the reason that I... say go see this movie. And Tommy, I know you said you listened to the Shining episode, but in the past we've somewhat and listeners, if you don't know this, we've somewhat dove into my history, not my actual addiction, but with my family and people around me, and with their history with addiction and how close and personal that is for me.
Okay.
So when I'm watching this movie and I see Ewan McGregor and I see him, you know, escaping into the bottle, it stuck right there. It's personal at this point. And I got so invested. The reason that this movie, I would say go see this movie, is that this movie for me was one of the better parables than a lot of movies have been recently. It is a movie that has a lot of symbolism, a lot of open-ended symbolism. So you can kind of take it and personalize it and look at it in different ways. And this is definitely spoil territory. So the way that I got to addiction is that you have this guy, you have Dan Torrance, who suffers basically from the same thing that his dad did. And in this case, yes, he was actually an alcoholic, but let's look at The Shining. Let's look at these demons that ail you as the actual addiction, and he tried to escape it, right? He had you drink to get away from those demons. You drink to dull
or
numb
it's
that
the medicine.
Pain. Yeah. Yeah, it's the eraser. And so we saw it multiple times when I think that like the trigger for Danny's addiction was death or the fear of death.
Yeah.
And you notice that when he gets clean and everything, he then gets a job literally as the title of the
hospice
movie is
care worker,
Dr. Yeah. Sleep.
Yeah.
He's put in a situation where he gets to look at death and he gets to discover that it's not as bad. He gets to face that fear. He gets to understand it a little bit better so that it's not as triggering. And then if you look at like what like AA does. So you go through AA, you get better, and several years down the road, the natural progression is to be a sponsor for somebody. And you progress more as you help other people. That was this dude's journey. He turned to somebody for help who was an addict. He turned to somebody for help. He got better himself. He faced the trigger that would always get him to drink. And once he got to a point that he was a little bit stable, then a ghost literally comes to him and says, "You have to save this girl because the addiction
Halloran,
is after
Halloran.
Her."
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the addiction, right? Because all of the true knots are the literal. I mean, they're the definition of addiction.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're hunting you. They're trying to get you to turn.
So I love this thing that you just said, because if you look at this movie as the is the hero's journey for Ewan McGregor or the Dan Torrance from fear of death to embrace of death as like a natural and beautiful like stage of life. That then the villain of this movie, like, what is the whole point of them is to not die, right?
Yeah,
that's whole point. Mm. So like the villain of this movie. The villainous, the principle of this movie is fear of death. And so you see the way that these characters interact with the fear of death. Dan Torrance, you know, his ultimate progression as a character is to embrace it so entirely that he is willing to die.
Yeah.
And Rose the Hat is willing to do literally anything. Literally anything to not die.
To not die. Yeah.
And so are all of her friends and you know, cohorts.
Which was why the end like line of Abra talking to her mom saying, you know, like death isn't the end. Like,
yeah.
They go on. It made it really powerful for me because it was like it was this full circle idea of fearing death and literally locking those demons in a box, like suppression to the max, and then having this climax in this movie of releasing those demons and learning to deal with it. And then it came full circle.
Yeah.
That's the double hit. That's interesting though, because if she had just said, "We go on," we already knew that "We go on." Everyone that passed away in the Overlook went on. There is a bad death.
Yeah.
Meaning you don't necessarily go to a great place. Not everyone is meeting their loved ones. Some people are still trapped. I mean, the Overlook Hotel at the end of The Shining really sort of seems to be almost like a psychic battery. Like so many crazy things happen in there. It's a lot like Richard Matheson's Hell House, where so much debauchery and evilness happened in there that it's like the hotel itself soaked it up.
Yes.
And keeps people there. So I like the idea, CJ, like what you're saying is she does say that we go on, but then also, and he's okay.
Yeah.
I think that's a two-part, it's very important for both of those to be there. Because the "we go on," unfortunately, we know
may not be great.
Because gross lady in tub has been chasing after Danny Torrance for forever, and she's still, she's still in the tub. So pruney.
Ooh. Yeah, if she would just stay out of the tub for a little while, right? Maybe things would get better for her.
Take a walk.
Ooh. And also, all of Rose the Hat and all of the other Crow Daddy and all of the rest. You get the strong sense that when they perish, they don't go on. It's like they've given away their opportunity,
right?
And it's not stated obviously, but there is this like. there's this great moment where, oh man, it's one of the scenes that I love. I love so many scenes in this movie. I love so many scenes.
Me
and
too.
One of the scenes that I love is Rose talking to Grandpa Flick when Grandpa Flick is dying.
Oh yeah.
And trying to reassure him because he's saying, I'm afraid. And she's trying to do what Dan Torrance is doing for the elderly in hospice. She's trying to do for her friend, her oldest friend in this group, her mentor. And all of the things that she's saying, it's so beautiful because all the things that she's saying, you know, don't matter.
Yeah.
You've seen empires rise and fall. Yeah. There's a huge difference.
What he says and what she says, you're exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, oh my gosh, that symmetry between those two scenes, the first time we see Dan Torrance helping someone accept death, And going on, she conspicuously doesn't say that you go on. She says it's okay that you don't go on because you've done so much.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in this moment dying, and it's like it doesn't matter what I've done. If I don't go on, it's terrifying and it's over.
That's a really interesting point. I didn't think about that.
Quite beautiful.
He also says, "Remember a happy moment." And then I remember a moment of actual connection with one other person, and you can hear the radio playing, and they share a together moment where she's saying is, you witnessed history.
Yeah.
And there's a big difference between those.
Not actually part of it in any meaningful way. Not actually connected to anybody, just an observer.
And that people were afraid of you, whereas he brought up a situation of, do you remember a situation when you were happy and you were loved?
Yep.
Which is a really big, that's a great comparison.
I really love that. And I also just to kick it back real quick to the CJ's mentioning of the tie-in with AA and addiction and all that. And speaking of connection too, because it really this movie communicates so powerfully that connection is the road to salvation. Like that there is no salvation without connection. His 8-year sober speech on the stage at AA, and he's talking about his dad, which I've never loved Ewan McGregor more than in that moment. That was the most powerful, like earth-shatteringly beautiful performances like I've ever seen from him. And I mean, just heartbreaking and lovely and sweet and powerful and everything. And him talking about his dad, which, as a sequel to The Shining, our exposure to Dan Torrance's father is not positive. He is one of the great, great terrifying movie villains of all time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm thinking of here's Johnny and here's him saying, you know, my dad's proudest moment was taking a 5-month chip and wanting to give that to us. And I'm like sobbing. And so he has this moment. As he's accepting his 8-year chip, and we see his just total transformation of who he is as a person, and the way that he is connecting to his father, who was a psychopathic murderer haunted by ghosts at the end of his life, that he was able to reach past and through all that to the actual human of his father, that when he gets to the hotel, back to the hotel, and has a confrontation with his father as a ghost, that he is able to be saved by his connection to the better part of what his dad is that is not on display there, but it's his ability and finally his connection to his mother, which is what we see right as he is sacrificing himself in the boiler room of the hotel. It's really lovely, and then we all obviously get the more blatant examples of Dan and Abra communicating with each other telepathically, and that when they can't communicate with each other telepathically for whatever reason, that is when they are their weakest. That is when they are at their most vulnerable.
Yeah.
At the moment when that connection is severed, he nearly takes a drink. She nearly despairs. That connection is so vital to the success of these characters, which I think, you know, this is not like a new theme. This is not something that is, that we've never seen before. I really love the way it's done so much, but it is also not a totally ubiquitous theme, because one of the things that we often see in powerful stories and stories that feel universal and feel empowering are the moment when the character, the protagonist, has to summon the strength to pull through alone. When they're all alone. Yes, the hero's when they've journey. Been abandoned by everyone. Yeah. Yeah, that is a vital part of the hero's journey. And this movie basically rejects that idea.
Yeah.
That it, in the moment that our characters are separated or disconnected, they are going to lose. And then the moment when they are reconnected is the moment that they are able to obtain that victory over the obstacle.
In a way, there's looking at it as like they kind of went on their hero's journey apart for a while. And then they met a real foe that then needed to sort of like team up, because Rose the Hat had her whole clan. And so Abra needed Uncle Dan and vice versa.
Yep. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. Which is.
And not to mention the very, very important character where his death was terrible, which was Billy, the best friend. And that was probably for
Wait,
me.
Wait, which one? I'm sorry.
It's Cliff Curtis plays him.
Yeah.
The friend who like gets him the apartment and goes to AA.
His sponsor.
When she forces that one character forces her. Yeah, that was rough.
Snake by Andy says kill yourself. For me that was like I just am a sucker for like brother relationships because I was very much into that relationship and how quickly they just kill the guy. Yeah. Like I had no time to prepare. I wasn't ready. I thought they won. And then it's just like, kill yourself. And then it just happens. And I was like, wait a second. No, I don't want this. Never mind. But I thought it was a really effective moment for me because that was kind of when Danny was, because then after that he couldn't reach Abra, and that's what led him to almost drink. Yep. So his purpose and his biggest strength had been removed from him.
Yep.
And again, parallel to addiction, which is that it is scientifically proven that those that are alone simply cannot
affliction of isolation.
Yeah, it's an addiction is an affliction of isolation. The parallels there were really effective for me.
And no, that makes all the sense in the world. And that's so great that you have that in some way, I don't know what it is, in your life, and yet it resonated honestly for you, CJ.
Yeah.
That's wonderful, because I assume there are a million movies that get that wrong. I've got to assume that there are tourists writing about something like that. I mean, one of the things that this movie is drenched in the book, and The Shining is drenched in alcoholism, is that, you know, Stephen King very famously was an alcoholic for a very long time and was a very drug addicted and everything. So a lot of this movie is a love-hate letter to that. Also, very cynically, as a screenwriter, having both of them lose someone so enormous, Abra loses her father, he loses his friend, being able, very cynically, I'm saying this, being able for him to say, I'm sorry that you lost your father, she says, I'm sorry you lost your friend, and then the movie can go on, instead of having one or both of them curl up into a fetal position. Because the movie has to keep moving. That is also a shorthand way of shared tragedy, is a way of letting the movie keep moving forward. And as an audience, we feel okay that they're able to still go on this adventure. And in the very next scene, like fall asleep or be woken up and have a normal conversation. They can sort of, it's almost like a script burial of sense.
That's a really good point. I was gonna call out to that scene, that just wonderful, like wonderful, horrible parlor trick, as it's called. And there was a really interesting moment for me when they stop and they stop at the at her house and they meet her father, and her father, you know, reacts the way a father would.
That was neat.
That whole scene was, I think, handled very, very well, much better than expected. And when they left, and when you see Abra in the backseat of the car as they're driving toward this destination, as they're going to quote unquote use her as bait, that moment, like I remember this so clearly because I was, and I'm not sure how I feel about this yet, except for that I don't know how else you possibly could have done it, but that when I saw her in the back of the car with these two guys, I was thinking, okay, there is no way in like hell that her dad is going to let her go without him. I was literally in the theater. I was like searching the frame to see if I could see her father in the car. I was like, he's not in there with her. I was like, that's impossible. That's literally impossible. Like you have told me something untrue. Like this cannot be happening. And so, but you know, you kind of like, well, I guess I have to let it go because the movie's continuing to go, you know, and then it makes sense. It makes sense because she's not actually there. It's like, which is a really like, boy, howdy. There's like a more dangerous place to like, to misstep, right? Like it's in that kind of relationship because if that hadn't been the way that turned out, if that hadn't been the sort of like the reveal and she actually was there with them, that's one of those things that like robs you of trust of the writers.
Especially,
you're like, no.
Especially because they brought it up earlier in the movie where they're sitting on a bench and he's like, hey, in this day and age, this doesn't look okay.
No. And then you see, her father almost kill him with just for showing up. So that I thought that was very cleverly handled. And if you were paying attention, you probably, like I wasn't apparently, you probably would have been able to guess what was going on, but I didn't.
All right. So we've been here a while. Let's move on to the somewhat of the critical thoughts that we have had for this movie.
Tommy, tell us why you used to think that this movie wasn't very good.
Now that I'm completely on board. Because I loved, we've already sort of talked about this other movie that had nothing to do with The Shining.
Yeah.
Most of what we've talked about in this last chunk of like the last 40 minutes or so has nothing to do with The Shining at all, except that Danny Torrance exists. And Danny Torrance could have been an alcoholic just on his own. That it just felt like there was too much shoved in there. It started to break some rules for me about what Shining was. Okay. Or I'm still unclear about how. Okay, wait. Let me sum it up. Let me go to the end. When we finally get to the Overlook, it feels like 9 hours have gone by, which I'm okay with. I'm fine with long movies, but I was like, oh, right. The fact that we went to the Overlook, the fact that the Overlook had no real connection to the story except this vague, the Overlook, he says that the Overlook is dangerous for people like us. The Overlook is dangerous for everyone. And Jack Nicholson, Torrance, has no shining. He's just a damaged person, and the hotel can feed on the damaged. So it felt like it just always, even in the book, it felt forced to me to make it a sequel.
Okay.
Because I didn't think that the two parts really work together that well. And every time that the script tries to make them work well, it's a little shifty to me.
All right. So have you guys both seen 10 Cloverfield Lane?
Yes.
Yeah.
What's the worst part of that movie?
When they're
there is no worst part. That's a great movie.
I love that movie, but for me, it's when they're out.
Yeah. Me, it was a really, really good movie.
Oh, you're saying connecting it to the universe of Cloverfield.
But when she gets out and suddenly it's an alien movie and it takes a completely different turn, it was like, wait a second, this is not...
I know we're not here to talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane.
No.
But we need to eventually? Just for a second here, part A of my two-part response is that 10 Cloverfield Lane was not supposed to be connected to Cloverfield other than that
it's very connected.
No, it wasn't. Mean? It was
those not, aliens, not originally, those, but that's what I'm saying.
Oh, those originally,
aliens,
no.
No, no, I'm saying those aliens had nothing to do with the alien that came in Cloverfield. It was a titular similarity. It was not a world building similarity. It was not supposed to exist in the same world as Cloverfield. It was
what?
Just like,
here's are you sure?
No,
I'm almost positive of this.
That is not you can third, that's not the way it was marketed.
You can fact check me.
The third Cloverfield movie that debuted on Netflix was definitely in the same universe. universe as the first one.
We don't even have to talk about that movie. Okay, that movie may as well not even exist. The fact that Netflix bought it basically deleted it from existence. And the second part of my two-part response is that the ending of that movie is the reason that movie was so awesome.
Oh man,
because
my argument went in a different direction than I expected it to
because the ending of that movie puts such an interesting it magnifies the question of everything that came before.
Because he was right.
Sure, yeah. Okay. Like how
we're not talking about that
okay.
movie.
So anyway, let me just really quick about the,
CJ, I agree with you. When I watch 10 Cloverfield Lane, once she finally breaks out, I honestly stop watching.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She makes a left into the city. I love the very end, but that whole barnyard sequence, I didn't think was that great. Interested.
It was a completely different movie. That yeah. it was fantastic. A good example of this movie having the trial, the obstacle of needing to connect to the show.
I get that argument and I don't think it's a bad argument. I think that it's a good argument, and I think that I'm willing to grant some shoehorning. I'm willing to grant that there is some shoehorning. And
can you also then grant some more shoehorning?
Are you trying to shoehorn more shoehorning?
I don't think
into
your
my concession
is big enough. Yeah.
What I want to say is that I actually think it's quite lovely.
The
Shining is part of this movie because. So first of all. A positive comparison that I thought of, and not to dredge up a more controversial author than Stephen King, but Orson Scott Card was my first favorite author when I was young because of Ender's Game.
It's my It's my favorite book of all time, and then I'm still dealing with his homophobia. But yes, it's my favorite. It's still my favorite book of all time.
Yeah. And it's not my favorite book of all time anymore, but it's one of my favorites, and it was for like 20 years.
Sure.
And I love that book. I love that book. And
you're giving me two books to borrow. That's one.
And
of them.
That was one of them. Yeah. So I love that book, and I also loved Speaker for the Dead, which is a sequel to Ender's Game.
Which is weird, though. So you're gonna
get on board with me.
Okay. Yeah.
All right.
This is exciting.
Ender's Game, Speaker for the Dead, had to be a sequel to Ender's Game, but they are completely different books. They are 100% different. They are different stories. They're different characters. They're different worlds. They're
different type of sci-fi writing.
Speaker for the Dead
is hard sci-fi.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's different everything. Different everything. They are not similar. They are not connected in any way other than that. The main character is Andrew Wiggin / Ender from Ender's Game. And other than that, Ender's Game, the book, had to happen before Speaker for the Dead. Like, Ender's Game is part of that world.
Yep.
And so I'm not going to go so far as to say that The Shining and Dr. Sleep are connected so powerfully and so perfectly, but I will say that I think that they work together well enough to make a similar argument, which is that Dan Torrance is an alcoholic because of the trauma, the very real and very horrific trauma that he went through as a child, which was never resolved.
Right.
And that Dan Torrance, in dealing with that through the course of the story of Dr. Sleep, which is about gifted children, and it is about the supernatural that is sort of in the world, and it is about the predators and the prey in that world of the supernatural, that he, in going through that story, needed to eventually go back and reconnect to his childhood trauma to both save himself and the other characters in the story. And it is so lovely to me that the Outlook Hotel became the solve for the central conflict of the story. That digging back to the going back to, because he is a different person, you know? Dan Torrance, the adult, is contains within him Dan Torrance the child, but is a different character. And so going back and digging up that his child and literally releasing all of the ghosts and demons from their coffins to overcome and to have essentially just transcended that entire experience to the greater good, to gift that brand new life to Abra and let her be the hero of whatever the next story is, I think is a wonderful way for The Shining to be included in this, given everything that The Shining was, because The Shining is also a story of trauma. It's a tragedy of trauma. It's a right. horror of trauma. But it absolutely, I think, absolutely fits into the story of Dr. Sleep.
Interesting. It got very interesting at the end, what your point was, because when you were originally saying about Ender's Game versus Speaker of the Dead, my original thought was, do you remember that part in Speaker of the Dead where we had to re-go back and meet everyone in Ender's Game and then go back to where Ender's Game took place and then sort of make up a new history? No, because that never happened. That's the difference. It's just character motivation based. But I do like what you're saying about the idea of actually going back to where most of the trauma happened and uncovering that kind of stuff and literally digging up the bodies. Not literally, but in a way. It's interesting. It didn't. I guess I wished, you know, maybe I'm just being a real jerk about it, because there were no hints to a sequel in The Shining. Not that I want hooks for everything like this, but everything after The Shining that happens in Dr. Sleep is completely new and made up. That's all these. There's the idea that people feed on The Shining. That's the idea that the hotel is still alive. In the book, very famously, of The Shining, the entire hotel blows up. This movie, it's a weird hybrid between the book and the movie. In the original The Shining, the book, he forgets to check the steam valve and the entire hotel blows up. It's only in the movie that the hotel lives and he dies in the hedge maze.
In the book, what happens, like, yeah, so, I'm sorry, you probably are just about to answer this question that I'm in the process of asking. So
right.
Continue,
in the, yeah, I don't. Well, I think if Stephen King wrote it, I think what I remember from the book of Dr. Sleep is that it is not a real hotel anymore. It's a bunch of, it's like a bunch of, like boards and bricks and stuff hanging out. It's not like they closed it and let it rot. It was destroyed and they just didn't do anything with it. So in the book, no one goes back, if I remember correctly. Man, I hope I get this right. There isn't this like reconnection with the hotel, because as Stephen King wrote the book, and Stephen King very famously hated Kubrick's vision of the film, Stephen King blew that sucker up. So there was no hotel to sort of go back to. The Overlook for me, I didn't get the shivers or the excitement or the tingles that I wanted from most of the Overlook section. A lot of it was like a real-time turn-on lights simulator. Like, he was just sort of like walking through hallways.
Boy, Tommy, I gotta tell you, I did. That part
did you
was,
love it?
That part
okay.
was startlingly effective for
That's
me.
Because like, there was one part that was really effective to me when he walks into the gold room and there's that one glass. Jack
yeah,
Torrance's glass
yeah, that was
sitting
good.
On
that
the let it bar. And then Henry Thomas showed up as the recast, that started to get really distracting to me. But when he showed up and started to have the conversation with now the new Lloyd before we saw that it was Harry Thomas, that was like, I get it. I know what Flanagan is trying to make me feel.
Yeah.
But for a lot of it was just like, I kind of felt like I was watching light bulbs turn on in order.
Man, I you know, that like every time I was,
you, loved
you know,
it.
I was sitting there, I loved it. And I, here's the thing. I don't know why. I can't tell you why. I actually consciously almost like out of body experience during that scene, because I was like, I am so uncomfortable and afraid right now.
Because you
and
guys
I'm
both
having
had
this,
such a dread experience, have such a dread experience with The Shining. I remember from your body.
But even, I would say even more so, it's like, here's what happened for me, I think. Because I've like I said on our episode on The Shining itself as a movie, as I watch it, doesn't frighten me so much as it's just kind of
it's
disturbing
unpleasant.
Movie.
yeah,
and then I'll have nightmares later. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I had nightmares after we did our episode on The Shining, just from
thinking about
it. And
oh,
so
man.
And that's so great. When we, I mean, so when I was sitting in the theater and he was going into, like, literally from the moment that he crosses into the threshold from the snow, and then as lights start coming on, I had like a visceral fear reaction, like that palpable horror type fear, and it was being dredged up in me from that place that The Shining planted it, basically. So it's like,
oh, I'm so jealous. To, like, that's so
sprout
great.
And bloom. And as he was like making his way through that hotel, I got to tell you, like, pretty much every turn and every step and every light that turned on, like, built on that feeling of like dread and horror to the point that I wanted out of that building so badly that I, like, it was, and I could see myself feeling these things, and I was like powerless over like stopping. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is really effective for me. Yeah, I was so surprised.
If that was the feeling I had, I would enjoy it as much as you did too. I didn't have that feeling, and I was trying to figure out why.
I'm just a sucker.
Just really into it or able to, I mean, I try to watch movies like that really leaned in and like a raw nerve. I just couldn't with this one, but that's
remarkable. I was trying to figure out why that was the case for me, and the only thing that I could come up with is part of the reason of the dread and like the fear and the uneasiness that came along with The Shining was because of a plethora of unanswered questions, and we didn't really have a firm grasp on what this thing was, and so you never really knew what was going to happen. Sure. In this movie, the reason that it didn't feel connected to The Shining in a lot of ways, but probably the biggest, which was tonally for me, was because this became kind of an action movie, a supernatural action movie, and all of the rules had been established. Mm-hmm. And so as he's going through, I'm not scared of anything because I'm like, oh, homeboy can just open a box and throw him in there and we're good. Mm. And so all of the rule, there was no more ambiguity that I got lost in and felt that feeling of dread. And so,
that's a great, great point. I think for me, the big, because you're right, in order to feel that dread, you do need an unanswered question. And I think for me, the unanswered question is, and it was very much connected to, and I think this is kind of where I'm going back to, because when I was thinking, while I was feeling those feelings, and while I was observing myself feeling those feelings, the other thing that I was thinking alongside that is, like, sort of as I was exploring that sensation, where it was coming from, is that I kept thinking about him as a child. And I kept thinking, like, when you go back to a place that hurt you very badly as a child, what is that like as an adult? And I know that what happens is that a big part of you regresses back to that child. And so the unanswered question for me is, which Dan Torrance is walking those halls? Is he the adult Dan Torrance that is going to be able to open up those boxes and trap the ghosts, like a freaking Ghostbuster? Yeah. Or is he Danny who is going to be consumed by this evil? And like that, I think that question hangs open all the way up until you mentioned this, Tommy, when he gets to the bar and sees the glass. Oof. That's the moment that we get to discover which Dan is walking the halls of this hotel.
Yeah.
So for me, the big unanswered question, and I was literally asking myself this question as he was walking. I was like, I don't know. I was trying to put myself in his shoes. I was desperately trying to put myself in his shoes because I was trying to answer this question that was so important to me because I was afraid. And I was like, why am I so afraid? Would I be afraid if I was him? You know, and I was like trying to answer that question, like, would I be afraid if I was Dan Torrance walking those halls right now? And because I'm afraid right now, because as a kid, like watching this movie, this terrified me. And and as a young adult, even like being like exposed to the images of this hotel, this evil place, like it was so terrifying. It was sort of traumatized in this minor way as an audience and vicariously as this child. Right. Like, How do you do that? Because I can't imagine a more traumatic experience than what this kid went through at the Overlook Hotel, and to go back there and to allow the hotel to wrap him up in its embrace. Because, like, what do we all know about a haunted house? Once you go in, there ain't no guarantee you're coming back out.
Right.
And as it turns out, he doesn't leave again.
Yeah,
right.
He dies there. And so it's a lot of. Anyway, that's that. I think that's why I was feeling those things, and I wish I could. I can never anticipate that. I don't know if I could reconstruct it, but yeah.
Well, I definitely want to see the movie again because I'm a huge, as I've already said, I'm a huge proponent of seeing something again because how you're feeling, like maybe I was tired. Maybe I've just watched The Shining too recent. Maybe whatever, I was drunk. Don't judge me. Point being of like, that's not funny. That's not funny for this movie, especially. I know.
We didn't make the connection until you said
that's
that.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
I would like to have felt that way because the music very much told me it was time to feel that way.
I was just being obedient. The
music was like, now's the time to get that extra pair of pants ready. And I was like, I don't know. I'm just watching lights turn on. But no, again, not to repeat myself, but when he went into the bar, I was like, this is what I'm supposed to be feeling the entire time. So to his credit, even in my stage, that scene worked. Yeah. And really, I mean, if people are interested in more of Mike Flanagan's work, he is very obsessed, kind of like, not obsessed, he's fascinated by, in the same way that Wes Craven is, about trauma being passed down through generations. That kids are paying sometimes Wes Craven is very, all of his work is about kids paying the price for their parents' sins. Mike Flanagan is about the passing down of trauma, as you said, like from House on Haunted Hill. That's entirely what that entire series is about. Really, all of his movies are. So that's why this was such a perfect fit for him.
Yeah. Great point.
Yeah.
Great point.
Love that. Well, do you have something more?
One last thought.
Okay.
Just to throw you another bone, because I feel like you've thrown me a lot of bones, Tommy, and I appreciate it.
Hooray!
No, you've been very generous. But I want to say, you know, earlier you said that this was so many movies in one.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. And I would, and normally, often I would take issue with that. In fact, I can't remember the more recent episode that we did where I complained about how many movies a movie was. Oh, we're talking about Interstellar. We were talking about Chris Nolan's Interstellar.
So many movies. So many movies.
So many movies.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't, it was it was frustrating because none of them seemed to really, be full movies. Anyway.
Sure.
And I think I would have a similar problem with this if not for, I think for me, as I was geeking out at the beginning, that the most horrific of inciting incidents,
Jordan
the murder
Tremblay
scene,
hangs
it all together. And I think,
yep.
you know, I think that you, there's a fair criticism to be made that this movie is maybe trying to do too many things in a 2.5 hour span. It does feel long, which is telling.
Right.
So it did work for me, but I think that there's definitely merit in that criticism. And I want to make sure that that's on the table before
I appreciate that. I would be in an alternate universe. I would be interested in seeing a version of this movie that had nothing to do with The Shining just to see it. I'm not saying that it would be better or maybe a lot of the residents would be left, but just the son of an alcoholic who used to have powers, that they didn't have to go to the Overlook, that there wasn't this same Shining thing. I think that's just what I got hooked up on, is that we took this existing mythology, which is so iconic. Quiet, Foster. My dog's freaking out. this I get it, and then just kept adding to it. Now there's a bunch of people. Now there's people that feed on it. Now it's called steam. There's people wearing hats. None of these things existed before. And so I would just be interested. But no, I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah. Cool. So CJ, I'll let you do what you're doing before.
Yeah. I was just saying that I think we're about at time. But Tommy, you have been a delight.
Ugh, I hope so. I feel like I talked too much. But thank
No.
That was fantastic.
The rule of this podcast is that if anybody talks too much, it's me. That's the rule. It is so far over 110 episodes. It is an unbroken rule.
Are you guys saying I'm the new Jordan? Hooray! So everybody, we'll be back next week on the new Jordan. No, it was an absolute pleasure. You guys, this is a great podcast. We were so happy that you were able to join us, Jordan, on ours. And this has been an absolute pleasure. You guys, there's a ton of film podcasts and there are some that are doing it right. And it's a pleasure to be a part of one that isn't based on just snark and isn't based on just poking, you know, bad movies and stuff. We have enough of those. And so it's a real pleasure.
Well, thank you. That's really appreciate that high praise.
Remind people what podcast they can find you on.
Yes, it is The Next Reel. R-E-E-L, Pete Wright and Andy Nelson are there every week. They do sort of long weekly stretches on like a certain filmmaker or a certain genre. And then I come on with a couple other people usually about once or twice every month. And we're called the Film Board. We review a movie right after it comes out. And just sort of give basic feedback about that. Thenextreel.com. We would love for you guys to come check us out. We appreciate it.
Not to be confused with RealContender.com.
Yeah.
Which is the nominal production company under which Nerd Critic operates.
Yeah.
Maybe there will be a partnership one day. Anyway.
I think we should. Also, I'm Mark Maron. Okay, go ahead.
Hopefully we don't get sued for that. No, seriously, Tommy, thank you. It has been an absolutely wonderful experience having you on the podcast. I hope that we do this again not too much time hence.
I would absolutely. I had such a fun time tonight. I would absolutely love to. So that's great.
Glad to
thank
hear
you
it.
Very
that's
much.
That's great. Well, thank you very much. And we also want to also thank very much Michael Bonmiller.
Yes.
For the outro music. And sometimes I didn't prepare you for this, Tommy, because I never do prepare our guests for this.
I always forget until now.
And then I always ask, do you know what our sign-off is? And if so, would you like to give it?
I do, and I would love to. Hey, everybody, you've been Nerd Critic'd. Is that it? I gave it a shot. Is that not it?
That was real.
That was amazing.
I think we have to change our sign-off.
That was fantastic.
Well, until we do, everyone, please remember to love movies like a nerd and respect them like a critic.
And cut.